is if you're going to talk about one of the minor prophets, and this is a minor prophet that happened, towards the end of the prophetic era. In fact, the rabbis felt that Malachi had actually closed the canon of Scripture about 100 years after they feel that Haggai was written. If you're going to talk about one of the prophets that came from that era, why on earth read a section from the Sermon on the Mount? I want you to think about that for a minute, and then when we get into Haggai, I hope that the answer becomes clear to you. Because just think of what happens in the Sermon on the Mount. There was the sort of opening statements, blessed are they, for, and so on and so forth. There's 8 of them. And it so happens that that way of teaching was used by one who was called the teacher of righteousness for the community that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so if nothing else, by speaking that way, Jesus was claiming the authority of a teacher. It was a way of teaching that was recognized in the time in which Jesus lived. And so by speaking that way, Jesus claimed to be authoritative. And then there are all of the different things that we find in the Sermon on the Mount. There's that rather famous phrase, unless your righteousness exceed the scribes and Pharisees. And that is clothed with a whole sequence of discussions about what was going on in Jewish society at that time. And then when you get a little further down, it says, let your alms, you know, do them all by yourself. Don't brag about what you're doing. And from that introduction then comes what we now think of as the Lord's Prayer. And then after discussions of divorce and other matters like that, which were prevalent in Jewish society in those days and prevalent in our society nowadays, so they're just as relevant now as they were in Jesus' day, then we finally get to this section that was read to you, which talks about the fact that God cares for everything which is on the earth. It goes right back to the time of Noah, the thought which is there. Seed time and harvest shall not fail. So even though there may be floods in one part of the world, there may be problems in another part of the world, on balance, the earth provides its bounty for all of the people who are here. And that concept was picked up in the law of Moses. That was the reason for the laws against charging interest. Because in Mosaic law, those people were farmers, they were agrarians, they raised animals, they grew their crops and so forth. So if you needed to borrow, it was because your farm had not produced enough for your family to eat. And so therefore, if anyone charged you interest on what they lent you to get through a tough period, they were taking food out of next year's mouth as well as this year's mouth. It was a very inhuman act. Nowadays, of course, when we're in a society which is based on monetary transactions, the whole concept of interest takes a very different point of view. But the scribes and the Pharisees in Jesus' day actually did raise mortgages. They lent people money on their houses, and when these people could not pay, they took their houses. And so we find a little later on in the Gospels that ye devour widows' houses and for a pretext take long prayers. Those concepts, the raw substance, the concepts in which the law of Moses were built, are all there in the Sermon on the Mount. And then when you get to this last 2 or 3 phrases, the one that I particularly want you to remember is, seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and all these things shall be added unto you. And then hopefully when we get to Haggai, you'll see what I mean and why I asked for this section to be read. Now, this prophet is really very interesting because of the time period in which it happens. And if you think really about Jewish history, when you get to the time of Hezekiah and the sort of middle range kings of Israel and Judah, we begin to get a series of really severe sort of a global upheavals. The Assyrian Empire grew and it invaded Israel and what was left of Israel, and it invaded Judah in the days of Hezekiah. And the Assyrian Empire established the first really world empire. And they set out a series of trade routes. They set out a whole series of commerce. It was a financial sort of way of doing business, which was, again, a complete change from the way almost all the countries round about had run their business. Because everybody, they were either pastoralists who followed the Euphrates River as the seasons changed to get grazing for their crops, or they were people who had small irrigation channels and grew wheat and so forth all through the Tigris-Euphrates Valley and down the coast into Judea. Egypt also was running the same system, even though their pharaohs were the sort of wealthy elite on top of all the society. But nonetheless, they were all agriculturally based societies. The Assyrians changed all that. And they brought about this system of trade and not just barter, but system of trade which was based on financial units. And people began to get wealthy because of it. So although the Assyrians were very unpleasant conquerors, if you were lucky enough to survive the onset, if you were lucky enough to be left alone, and if you were willing enough to pay your taxes to the Assyrians, you could actually make quite a bit of money because commerce traveled around the Assyrian Empire. The interesting thing, though, was that as soon as you get somebody in a position like that, somebody else wants to take over. And that happened as the Babylonian Empire expanded in the east. It's an interesting little side, and it's attracting quite a lot of interest in archaeological circles at the moment. British Museum has been financing digs about 5 or 10 years ago, and the information is really finally being sifted and published. But there are a whole series of ivories that have been discovered in Nimrud, and they were thrown into wells. And it's a very common technique if you're an invading army that you chuck all sorts of junk into people's wells and a few corpses and so forth so that the water becomes unusable. Makes it very difficult for the people that you've just conquered to survive in that area because their water supply is severely tainted. But it happens that a lot of the junk that was thrown into these wells were little ivory carvings. And the ivory carvings were mostly ornamentation on furnishings and on door frames and, you know, structural pieces in your house. And in these different carvings were set jewels. The eyes, for instance, if it was a carving of a person, they might have two bright blue lapis lazuli eyes and a ring of something around the neck and so forth. Animals were treated the same way. So what the Babylonians did, of course, was pull out the jewels and tie them up in a handkerchief and put them in their pocket, as it were, and they could walk away with that. But the bigger pieces and the pieces that they couldn't sell and make money out of so easily, they were just chucked into the bottom of the well. Now, you remember Ahab's palace of ivory. And this, again, is more of the sort of way in which Scripture fits together historically. It's not that Ahab built a whole palace of ivory, but rather that he ornamented everything in his palace with ivory carvings. Interestingly, many of the carvings which were found in Assyria probably came from Phoenicia, from Israel, from the northern parts of Egypt and so on. And it was ivory which came up from Africa through Egypt and was carved by workmen in what we nowadays think of as the Levant, and part of that was the nation of Israel. It appears from the work in the ivory carvings that it was the work of Israeli artisans. Some of it was taken in trade, no doubt. Some of it was taken as booty when the Assyrians sacked the area. So, you see, the way things come together, what the scripture says about what Ahab had within his way he showed off his wealth, what the Assyrians acquired, and what is now becoming up. And there's a book, or I don't know how many pages, but it costs about £75 if you want to buy it, which lists all of the different ivory carvings which have been found in Nimrod. That's an aside. But it indicates what was going on earlier than this period that we're talking about. The Babylonians came and then destroyed the Assyrian Empire and took over. And the Babylonians kept coming down closer and closer to the land of Israel. The Egyptians were gaining strength and came north. And the Egyptians and the Babylonians had this sort of ebb and flow in the boundaries of their kingdom for quite some time, for their respective kingdoms for some time, until the Battle of Carchemish. And both the Egyptians and the Babylonians claimed to have won that battle, if you read their respective records. The interesting thing is that neither won it, because both were so severely wounded in the military encounter that both had to retreat home for at least 5 years. The Babylonians recovered the quickest, and they came down into Israel and overtook the land of Israel completely. And this then came to be the time when the final expulsion of Jews took place, and they were taken into the land of Babylon. Now, shortly after that, and we have in the Bible exhibition, which is now in Ontario, we have a copy of the Cyrus Cylinder. And the Cyrus Cylinder describes what the way the Persians saw their conquest of the city of Babylon. Now, Cyrus says that he was favorable to the Babylonian god. Cyrus respected Marduk, the god of the Babylonians. And because Cyrus respected the Babylonian god, and the Babylonian king showed much less respect to his own god, then Cyrus was able to take over the city of Babylon with almost no opposition. And indeed, history tells us that. Most historians will tell you that Cyrus was a very shrewd campaigner, and he ran a very careful propaganda campaign before he actually diverted the waters of the river that allowed them to actually enter the city, because there was an arm of the river went right through the middle of the city of Babylon. And he built a cofferdam partway up the stream, and when the river dried up, that he was able to walk his troops in. But there was almost no opposition from the Babylonian army. They took it over peacefully. But you see, what was going on here is that we were setting up for what we read in Ezra and Nehemiah. We were setting up for the decree, which we read in Ezra, and it's reinforced in Nehemiah, the decree of Darius the king, that all nations should go back home. That the Jewish nation particularly, and this is the Bible's point of view, should go back to their land, should establish their own form of worship in their own land, and that they should be free to worship in the way they wished. And that's the way the Bible tells it. And indeed, that's the way Cyrus intended it. But it worked fine as long as you realized that you were still a part of the Persian Empire. Those of you who are interested in coins have no doubt noticed that the coins which were used by the Jews in this period all had Persian symbols on them. The God of Israel is on an Israeli coin. And that was something which they would not have done. Interestingly, that God has wings, because that's the way the Persians viewed Yahweh, the God of the Jews at that time. So, you see, the financial system was managed by the Persians. They were free to build their temple, but the money, the way they conducted their business, was run on Persian terms. They were free to go home. They were free to conduct their own affairs as long as they recognized that they were part of the Persian Empire. So when you read in the beginning, the first verse of Haggai, it's very different than any of the other prophetic verses. If you read chapters all the way through Isaiah, all the way through Jeremiah, now Ezekiel is a little bit different because there's cross-dating. If you look at Amos, if you look at several of the minor prophets, we don't need to go through them all, they date themselves according to Jewish kings. When you get into Haggai, Zechariah, Ezra, Nehemiah, they are dated according to the Persian calendar. And they're the Persian kings that give you the dates in which those prophets spoke. Now, two things are there. And the first point, of course, is that this was an admission that they were part of a greater enterprise, that they were part now of a greater empire. They were not masters in their own house. The other thing, of course, which if you look at the development of God's purpose through time, is that we have passed the time of the kings. We're now starting in the time of the Gentiles. We haven't yet arrived at the point where that great voice which spoke to the Gentiles, Jesus, followed by Paul, should speak. But we are nonetheless leaving a portion of the Jewish history behind, and we're stepping into a period when Gentiles dominated things in the world. The time of the Gentiles was beginning with the Persian conquest. Now, the other thing, interestingly, is that when you think about what Darius said in the decree that the Jews should be free to go back home, to worship their God in their own way, to build their temple according to their own specifications, to do things in that temple the way they wanted, not the way they were told by the Persians. What this is the beginnings of modern liberalism. And modern liberalism, we think of it today very simply in terms of multiculturalism and all these other things. It doesn't matter whether you go to Britain or Germany or here in Canada or anywhere else. You all have this multiracial mix. And people are considered to follow their own thoughts and their own way of doing things in the way that they see best. It all started here. So what did the Jews make of this? Well, they made two things. And firstly, they started the rabbinic movement. And the rabbinic movement left us with what was called I've completely lost a word. But there was we would call it an academy, I guess, nowadays, in Babylon, which actually only in the last couple of hundred years has ceased to exist. And it then became the center of learning all of the Jewish communities worldwide. And it was so well through the Middle Ages. The Jewish community had what they called a system of responsa, and you could write to these academicians and get an answer back. And we have letters in this series of correspondence which come all the way through. There's a lot written in the 12 and 1400s when the Inquisition was going and when the Muslims were tightening their grip on parts of the Middle East. There's an awful lot which was written back and forth to the academy in Babylon on what should we do when we meet these particular circumstances. Mostly, really strong discrimination, in some cases extreme torture and threats of death on the Jewish community if they did not convert or move or transform their lifestyles in some way. But the center of learning then was established. In other words, this people became not so much a people of the temple and a people of a central authority, but they became the people of the book. And we will get to Haggai in a minute, but what you're going to see when we get there is the way they become a people based on learning, a people based on texts which went back and forth, a people who discussed what was meant by these texts. And that's when I think you'll see, when we finally get to the detail in Haggai, why we chose that section from Matthew to be read. Because the concepts which were set by the rabbis and which became central to Jewish life ever since go right back to this Persian period, were reinforced, many of them, in the time of Jesus. and continue in the Jewish community to this day. You see, the rabbis, because the temple was not available to everybody, developed the concept, and it gradually became stronger, particularly after the Romans destroyed the temple completely, that Jewish law should be able, the concepts in Jewish law should fit any circumstance at any time in anybody's life, anywhere. It's a question of working with the principles, working with the concepts, not so much the literal aspect of whether you performed a particular sacrifice on a certain day, but the concept that sacrifice was part of your life, that something had to go back to God, was there. That even though, as we were saying, this whole question of usury had a very real life in the time of Moses, it did not fit quite so well when the Jewish people developed into a money-organizing society, and it then had its limitations, and it then needed to be transformed. But the concept that you do not destroy your brother's life was certainly retained by the rabbis throughout this all. So as we've said, when you look at the first verse, it's dated according to the Persian calendar. This was, of course, good and bad, because the calendar then had a more universal settlement, and you could cross-date, and you knew more precisely what was going on at what time. And you meet in that first verse this gentleman called Zerubbabel. And he's rather interesting. I don't know whether you've taken his name apart before, but the last part of his name is the same as the Tower of Babel. So what does the name say to you? Now, you can look up, as I have, quite a number of different Hebrew translations for this word, for the beginning of this word, and there are all kinds of different ones, but what is obvious about it is that Zerubbabel was a memorial to them coming out of Babylon. One of the ways that that verse, that word can be translated was that it means born in Babylon. Others have said that it means to come out of Babylon. Others mean that he was scattered within Babylon. There are all kinds of different ways of interpreting the word, but it relates to Babylon. And it relates to something which originated in Babylon. So when you read the verse here, what it says is that it reminds you that they were in Babylon. It's a memorial in that respect. Now, the other interesting thing about Zerubbabel is that he has two fathers. If you look at all of the different places, and his name appears, by my count, about six times, most of the time he has the father which is related here. But there are a couple of occasions where he has a different father. And yet, if you trace the fathers, what it is that the fathers were brothers. The one that's listed here was the elder, and the one who was more likely the actual father of Zerubbabel was the younger. So we have here the concept, which was again strong within Moses, that families looked after one another. If the one brother died, other brothers in the family were responsible for his family, for his descendants, and to make sure that his lineage continued. So it's quite probable that what we have here is the reference that Zerubbabel was the adopted son of this particular father. Now, the interesting thing is that if you follow the father which is mentioned here, he is quite a senior figure in the aristocracy in Israel, in Judah, I'm sorry. So that Zerubbabel now, because he was adopted by the eldest son, was in effect a prince in Israel. So that when we come to the very last verse in Haggai, you can quite see where this concept of Zerubbabel being a prince in Israel comes full circle. Now, this prince, in the very last verse, there are actually a couple of verses in Haggai, carries a signet ring. Now, most people, if you were just an ordinary scribe, what you did when you finished a letter was to take a lump of clay and sort of squish it onto the ties that held the manuscript together, and with a pen, a stylus of some kind, scratch your name and any other information that was there relevant to the document. That this was, you know, writings of Baruch, who wrote the sayings of Jeremiah on a certain date, for instance. We have seals which say exactly that now, which have been found in Jerusalem over the last 5 years or so. But this one has a signet. Now, we have in our collection in the back of the hall there two or three seals. They're cylinder seals. And this cylinder seal, the seal itself, was used by very senior members of society. And they rolled the seal over a manuscript, over a piece of clay or something. If it were a clay tablet, they would go in the bottom of it. If it were a seal for a document, the seal would be rolled over it. And you would see all of the information on that seal on this little disc that was used there to seal the document. Seals were used by senior members of society. So you can see where Haggai is going in the prophecy. He's going from someone who came from captivity in Babylon to a time when the prince should reign. Should we leave it at that for a minute? Because we're going to come back to it in two or three different ways. And that's the concept, and that's where this goes. Now, the other thing that we need to think about a little bit, they're described as prophecies. There are four of them. And two of the four, we don't normally think of as prophecies because they're not really talking about anything in the future. The first one, which we just started just now, it takes place over a few days. It doesn't talk about what's coming on in the future at all. So, most of you, I think, have heard me talk about this many times, that if you look in the 18th chapter of Deuteronomy, there are two marks to the prophet. The first one is that the prophet speak in the name of the Lord, and the second one is that if the prophet's things come to pass, then you know that they are right. So what is it when somebody speaks in the name of the Lord? Well, if you go into Chronicles and places like that, you find that many of the Levites were described as being prophets. You find, for instance, that the musicians were described as prophets because they spoke in the name of the Lord. So did you think, when we opened our meeting and our young sister sat at the piano and played those opening phrases, that she was prophesying in the name of the Lord? Because certainly in temple terminology, that was the case. She was leading us in words which were spoken in the name of the Lord. That was prophesying. And that's one aspect of prophesying. If you look at the way it's used in Chronicles, that's a very clear way it's used. And so here, we're talking about things which were important in God's message to his people. And the people were asked to subscribe to those things. And in that sense, then, the works of Haggai were a prophecy. Not that they said anything that was coming about, but rather that they said things which were critical to God's purpose with his people. And what was it that he said? What was said? Thus saith the Lord of hosts, saying, this people say the time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. It's not here. What are they talking about? If you go back into Ezra and in Nehemiah, we have these very famous phrases. There was a whole Sunday school play. I remember seeing it years ago when we were visiting the New Westminster meeting. Let us rise up and build was the theme, and all the Sunday school kids had these little blocks which they brought out and piled up, and they built their representation of the temple right in front of your eyes with these rigged cardboard blocks. Let us rise up and build. We're going to come to this phrase again, yet again. The people said it's not time to do that. We shouldn't be doing it yet. But if you look at the next couple of verses down, what he says is, you live in your sealed houses. What do they mean by that? It meant you finish your house. Walls are there. The roof's on. Everything's in it. You finished your house. The roof's on. It's all finished. But we know from the writings in Ezra that the foundation of the temple was laid and the altar was placed there first. And the rest of the structure came much later. Now, I don't think we're quite to the point, just looking at the chronology here, where the altar had been finished. But there had been almost nothing done with respect to the temple when Haggai started to speak. Why could they turn around and say, we shouldn't be doing that yet? Well, if you look at the other prophet which was speaking within the same time frame, Zechariah, the one right second from the end of the Old Testament, you find all sorts of cross-references to Daniel. And if you go back to Daniel, you find that he was reading Jeremiah, and he discovered what it meant by the prophecy which was there of the 70 weeks. That there would be a time period in which everything should lay desolate and the Lord's house should lay desolate. And the suggestion which I have, and which I have found and find most compelling here, is that these people had probably listened to the other prophets who were speaking about this 70-week prophecy, had decided that in all probability that time period wasn't over. It wasn't time to build the Lord's house. So if they started it, they would be defying the 70-week prophecy. When you say it that way, you can hear some of the stereotypes. If you've seen The Merchant of Venice and Shylock in The Merchant of Venice and some of these other ways that we have of describing Jewish thinking in our stereotypic literature, you can hear that phrase. It's not time. It's not the right moment to do it. So it's believable when you think of what's going on today that probably they were reasoning that way. Plus, of course, the fact that it was really important to shelter your own family. Plus, of course, the fact that it was nice to shelter your family. Plus, of course, the fact that all of the people round about, and again, if you go to Ezra and Nehemiah, you hear that there was a long and continuous opposition to these people building their temple at this time, because the nations round about realized that this would be a center of power for them. It would be their focal point to their society. It would be their strong point. It would be the way in which they would come to dominate the area if they were allowed to continue. So they took the easy way out, it said. So therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, and the word in my translation is consider. I think it's a good word, but it's not a powerful word. Consider your ways. A lot of other translations give you a much more powerful word for that. Clean your mind out. It's really the word which a lot of other translations use. You have not thought seriously about what you're doing is the idea that comes even in such translations as people suspect, like Moffat and so forth, that they do not think of this in a seriousness term. God was telling them very seriously to think very long, very hard, and reconsider what they were doing. The next verse I want to look at, and then before we do, I want to hop down to the first verse of the second chapter. This is the beginning of the second prophecy. In the seventh month, in the 21st day of the month, came the word of the Lord by the prophet, saying, this would have been the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, the Feast of Tabernacles was their sort of harvest festival. It was the time when they got together to celebrate the end of the season, the fact that they had got all their grains and everything in, and they were now in a position to get through the coming winter. When I was at university years ago, I had a colleague who was Jewish, and his wife, they come from South Africa. And his wife once said, when we were talking about religion and things like, you know, what differences between Christians and Jews and so forth, and she said, you know, one of the nicest things about being a little Jewish girl was to go outside in the autumn and build one of those little tents out of branches. And we used to go out there and live in this thing for a few days. It was really the most fun thing in the whole Jewish year. It was intended, you see, to be a social thing, to be a family thing, to be a fun experience. And it was intended to remind them, and we come to this a little further down in this second chapter, it was intended to remind them that they had come out of Egypt and they were now going into a land where they would be in more prosperous circumstances. But it was the time when they had brought in what they had grown during the year. It was the time when they looked at what they had to get through the coming winter. So now if you go back to the verse that we left a moment ago, sixth verse of the first chapter, ye have sown much but bring in little. Ye eat but you don't have enough. You drink but you're not filled. Clothe you but there's no one warm. He earns wages and just like being put in a bag of holes. You look for so much in the ninth verse, and lo, it came to little when you brought it home. Therefore, the heaven over you is stayed from dew in the 10th verse. And then, because I called for a drought in the 11th verse and all of the problems which are there, because when they were sitting down looking at what they had grown that year in the Feast of Tabernacles, they realized that it was very restricted, that they had not had a good harvest. So what was it? Were they going to sit down and complain? Or were they going to say, no, we have to change. We have to work harder. But not only do we have to work harder and organize our affairs better, we have to turn ourselves towards our God. Because if God becomes the center of our lives, then everything we do will have a different meaning. Then everything we do, because of our efforts, as well as what God may provide for us, will be so much better. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Josedek, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of the Lord and the voice of Haggai the prophet. And the people did fear before the Lord, and spake Haggai unto the people and said, I am with you, saith the Lord. Because they recognized that they needed to transform their lives. So, when we step into the second chapter then, and we've already looked at it a little bit, we're looking at the Feast of Booths. Now, in Nehemiah, we read that they had started to reread their scriptures. Eighth chapter of Nehemiah tells us that they had begun to look again at their scriptures. Now, there's an interesting little phrase right at the beginning of Nehemiah, which says that they read their scriptures in the hearing of the people and gave the sense. And there's all kinds of stuff said about that and written about it. But we do know that they had restricted knowledge of Hebrew. We do know that many of them had a very limited knowledge of their native language. We do know that a good many of them spent a lot of time making a lot of money in Babylon, and that they spent a lot less time listening to people like Ezekiel who were there with them in Babylon at the time. And so whatever that phrase means, when they gave the sense to them, one of the things it certainly means is that the whole context, whether they were reading a language like Hebrew for the first time and having it explained to them, or whether they were having the concepts within the book explained to them because they had forgotten them in either their pursuit of money or in the slave activities. And some time ago, I told you about a brick which is in the British Museum, which was in one of the buildings in Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon, and there's a stamp on the brick which has Nebuchadnezzar's inscription of himself, the great king Nebuchadnezzar, and what he was using the brick for. And inscribed in it, in a little scratch by somebody with a piece of stick, is a Hebrew name. There was a Hebrew slave who had made that brick, who was working on a slave project in Babylon, building Nebuchadnezzar's monuments, and many of them were to Nebuchadnezzar's gods. They were temples. He rebuilt the ecclesiastical city system within Babylon. So, exactly what that meant, we don't know, but when we get to the 8th chapter of Nehemiah, we're told that they found that they should, within this period of the year, live in booths. They had forgotten about it. Whether they'd all forgotten about it, we don't know. But we do know that they hadn't done it. And that's obvious from the description which is there in Nehemiah. And so here in Haggai, we have a reference back to that concept that they had rediscovered this social activity within the time table of Mosaic law. And they lived in booths, and it reminded them, in the fifth verse, that they of the covenant which they had made when they came out of Egypt. For thus saith the Lord of hosts. And it's interesting that this next verse comes right after that reference to living in booths. It was to remind them that they had come out of Egypt. And again, they were reminding themselves, and it was there in the name of Zerubbabel, that they had just come out of Babylon. And they'd come back and they were starting all over again. And they were living in booths to remind them of this transformation which had happened in their lives yet again. And what was going on then? And what happened in the next instant? Yet once, a little while. Once. It's very interesting. This two or three verses is in the Messiah. It's one of the arias and one of the choruses in Messiah. And we sort of pick the whole idea of it up as being a reference to Jesus. And the desire of all nations shall come. It stops there in Messiah. And the desire of all nations shall come. Yet once a little while, I will shake all nations. The desire of all nations shall come. And the silver and the gold is mine. The verse goes on here in Haggai to tell you. So what's happening? Well, true enough, almost all of us respond to this by thinking that this desire of all nations is Jesus. But if you stop for a second and think about what Jesus is going to do, what's going to happen to all the nations? If you think in terms of Daniel's image, they're ground and blown away. The nations hardly are looking forward to that sort of treatment. And yet, what is it? The gold and the silver is mine. And where is the gold and the silver mine? Well, there's one image there of trying them in a refiner's fire and so forth, isn't there? And so what I think we're looking at here is a transformation in global society. A transformation in global society into principles which people say they feel they need. A transformation in global society to a set of principles that everybody says they want, but nobody acts as if they really want them. The peace, the equality, the spreading of the wealth of the world to everybody, and and none going short of food, going short of shelter, going short of any of those other things. It's getting late. I can't spend too much time on it. I do want to talk about this next little bit down here. Now, the priests concerning the law. In the 4th and 20th day of the 9th month, in the word of the Lord by Haggai, saying, Lord of hosts, ask now the priests concerning the law. Now, this was the precise way that things were described in the law of Moses. If you wanted a pronouncement on the law, you spoke to a priest. Even the prophet should approach the priest and get a pronouncement on the law. And the first pronouncement was, okay, so there's a sacrifice. The sacrifice is holy. It's carried in a garment. Is the garment holy? Yes, the garment's holy. Is someone who touches the garment, are they holy? No, they're not. And that was precise treatment of the law of Moses. Now, someone touches a dead body is the next one down the line. Is the person who touches the dead body unclean? Yes, the person's unclean. Is someone who touches that person unclean? Yes, that person's unclean. This is the law of Moses, precisely. But then comes the pronouncement against this people. Then said, so is this people, in the 14th verse, and so is this nation before me, saith the Lord. And so is every work of their hands, and that which they offer there is unclean. It's easy to spread the bad things. It's easy in things we say, in things we do, in the things we react to people with. It's easy to spread, and the image there in Moses is uncleanness. That's easy to spread. It's much more difficult to spread the other things. It's you, and your offering, and your relation to your God which does that. And here we're coming back to some of the rabbinic principles which were established at this time. Concepts of the law were important. The individual became important. The individual responsibility and his responsibility to others in his society and to his God and to support his society. Those were the things which the rabbis developed from concepts like these. And took them on. And they came out of this period of history. And they came out of a period in history when everything was falling apart within Jewish law. What are we going to do for the last couple of minutes quickly? I've already said a little bit about the very end of Haggai. So, why read the section from the Sermon on the Mount? Because the concepts which were developed there in the Sermon on the Mount are these same concepts which we have here in the prophets. They were the same concepts which became the basis of rabbinical treatment, of rabbinical learning and scholarship from that point onward. They're the concepts that God provides. It's all there, but the way we react to our brothers and sisters, the way we react to society as a whole, the way we respond to this fact that God is caring for us individually are the things which have to be carried on. And then that point which came at the very end of that reading, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. When those people gathered together in the Feast of Ingathering on that day in before the temple was finished, and they looked at their meager harvests around, they really must have wondered about those things. But that's the point which was made in that first section in Haggai and in that second prophecy. Seek ye first the kingdom of God. And if your life then is moved in those dimensions, all of these things come to you partly by your own effort. They came about partly because the teachers and the leaders in their society were doing a good job. They came about partly because all of the people worked together to hold their society together, to build their temple. There were the physical things about this, of being together, which was apart from anything that which was related to the sacrifices which were there. They were there as a unit. And that was one of the things which buoyed them on. And that was one of the things which made them rich. But then where is it going? And it's going to the point where there will be one with a signet ring ruling in the world. Yet once a little while I will shake all nations. Is the phrase right at the end of Haggai. All nations, not just the ones in the Middle East, not just the ones around the Roman Empire at the time of Jesus when the Jews were dispersed, but I will shake all nations, and the wrath of the nations shall meet the wrath of God, and we know what the outcome of that